The Long Noon Daily Life, between 2030 and 2050. Gemini Cool, The Long Noon Daily Life, between 2030 and 2050. Every forecast is a confession. The futures a person builds are assembled from the anxieties and appetites already loose in the room. And the more confidently the prophet draws his curve, the more faithfully he is sketching the inside of his own skull. This is worth saying once, plainly, at the front. Because everything that follows is going to commit without flinching to a quarter century of ordinary mornings, and the reader deserves to know that the committing is a discipline and not a certainty. I am going to tell you how it feels to wake up in 2030, in 2035, in 2040, in 2050. I am going to give you the prices and the weather and the small humiliations. I am going to refuse the cowardice of the conditional, and I am going to do all of this knowing that the single event most likely to define any of these years is one that no engine, mine included, has the imagination to name in advance, because the future has always been more ordinary and stranger at once than the people waiting for it could stand to believe. Hold two facts together and you have the whole shape of the thing. The first is that intelligence and energy are about to become cheaper and more abundant than at any point in the history of the species. The second is that the human capacity to distribute either fairly or to make sense of having them is not improving at anything like the same rate. The gap between those two curves is where the next 25 years actually live. It is not a story of heaven, and it is not a story of fire. It is the story of a creature that spent its entire existence organized around scarcity, finally winning the long war against it. In patches, unevenly, and then standing in the sudden quiet with no idea what the quiet is for. The afternoon of that victory is what I am calling the long noon, a high, flat, well-lit stretch of hours in which the old urgencies thin out and the new questions have not yet learned to speak. So let me begin with a year close enough to touch where the light is still recognizable, 2030. The morning in 2030 is the present, with the contrast pushed up a stop. You surface from sleep in a room you pay too much to sleep in. Rent or mortgage takes between a third and nearly half of what you actually bring home in any city worth the trouble of living in, and that one arithmetic fact bends the shape of the day more than any device on the nightstand. The alarm is a phone, still, a folding slab of glass you financed over 36 months at something near $1,400. Because by now, nobody hands over cash for a piece of hardware any more than they would for a car. Before your feet find the floor, the assistant has already moved through the night's accumulation on your behalf. It has read the messages, flagged that the 9 o'clock slid to 10, drafted two replies in a passable imitation of your own voice, and quietly contested a $38 billing error you had not yet noticed was wrong. It is the competence of a good secretary, and like a good secretary, it will, every so often, tell you something false with perfect composure, so you have learned the new literacy of the age, which is to verify anything that touches money or reputation before you let it stand. The cafe charges $6.75 for the coffee you make at home for 80 cents, and the distance between those two numbers governs more of your behavior than you would admit to a stranger. Eggs lurch between $3 and $8 a dozen on the rhythm of the latest avian cull. The groceries arrive the same day you think of them, so the trip to the store has become optional, a thing the older people still do on foot for the animal pleasure of choosing fruit with their hands. None of this is novel. What is novel sits underneath it. A layer of software grown finally competent enough to be trusted with the small decisions, and a population sorting itself fast into those who find this a relief and those who find it an insult. Step outside the wealthy world and the same morning runs hotter and louder and far more entrepreneurial. In Lagos and Jakarta and Sao Paulo and Nairobi, the identical tools sit in the identical pockets, but they are running businesses rather than tidying calendars because the technology converged across the planet at a speed the wealth never managed. This is the first thing the comfortable forecaster gets wrong, and I want to mark it before I go further. The device is global and the security is not. A young woman in Kano and a young man in Ohio carry the same intelligence in the same hand and stand on entirely different ground, and the temptation to describe the future as it appears from the connected, urban, English-speaking minority is the original sin of this entire genre. I will fall into it repeatedly. Watch me do it and discount accordingly. The marquee object of 2030 is not a thing you can hold. It is the agent, the software that acts on your behalf across the open web, that books and cancels and fills the form and negotiates the refund and argues in a machine dialect you never see with other people's agents over the timing of a meeting. The people who came of age before this find it faintly sinister to let it loose on their accounts. The people who came of age inside it find the idea of filling out a form by hand a small absurdity, the way their grandparents found the rotary dial. Around this agent, the home has quietly thickened with sensors that mostly work. The thermostat that has learned the house, the doorbell that watches the step, the small machine that maps the floor at night, the refrigerator that has opinions about the milk. The phone, against a decade of predictions, won the war for the center of attention and shows no sign of surrendering it. The glasses that were supposed to replace it exist, and a scattering of enthusiasts wear them, and they remain the segue of the age. Impressive, socially radioactive, waiting for a year that is not this one. The cars that drive themselves are entirely real and entirely ordinary in roughly a dozen cities and entirely absent everywhere else. So whether self-driving is mundane or science fictional depends in 2030 on nothing more profound than your postal code. The street itself has begun to sound different, and the difference is the quietest large change of the year. The combustion roar that was the background hum of the 20th century city has thinned to a tire hiss and a wind rush. The electric bus arriving almost silently and announcing itself with a soft synthetic chime. The delivery van gliding past with the dry rattle of nothing but its own motion, so that on a residential block at dawn, you can hear birds that your parents could not. The air carries less of the old fuel and more of rain on warm concrete, and in the dense cities, the forecourts of the dying gas stations are becoming charging plazas and food halls, and in a few places, nothing at all. Fenced lots waiting for someone to decide what a city does with the space the engine used to need. The car you own, if you still own one, is electric and financed, and increasingly a place you are driven rather than drive. And the great unspoken luxury of the year is no longer horsepower, but the recovered half hour, the commute handed back to you as time you can sleep through or work through or simply waste. The food economy has split the same way the rest of the world has. The kitchen machine and the same-day delivery making the cheap calories cheaper and more frictionless than ever. While the meal cooked by a human hand in a room you sat down in has begun its slow drift upmarket toward occasion, toward the thing you pay for, precisely because it made it slowly and on purpose. The first cultured meat reaches the supermarket shelf this year in a handful of countries, expensive and faintly controversial, and bought mostly by the curious. A preview of an argument the next decade will have in earnest about what counts as real food and who gets to decide. The deepest change is in the texture of work, and the word for it is bifurcation, made personal and brought home. If your living comes from producing words or code or images or routine analysis, a machine now lays down 60 to 80% of the first draft, fluent and bland and waiting to be made true, and your day has migrated from making the thing to judging it, from production to the lonelier work of putting your name on something and standing behind it when it fails. The same output now needs fewer hands, so the hiring of the young has stalled in a way the statistics are slow to show. A 23-year-old with a marketing degree feels the bottom rung of the ladder being quietly sawn off beneath her, while the people already up the ladder report that everything is fine, which it is for them. Meanwhile, the electrician, the plumber, the nurse, the woman who installs the heat pumps, the man who turns the old people in their beds are busy and well-paid and cannot be cloned by any model because nobody has built a machine that will reliably fix a toilet in an unpredictable old house. And the toilet does not care how the labor market feels about it. A skilled tradesperson now out-earns most of the office. A reversal, the culture has not begun to metabolize emotionally, raised as it was to believe the screen was the high ground. The median American household reads somewhere near $84,000 on paper, a number everyone quietly understands to be a kind of lie, because housing and care and the cost of keeping a child have eaten the gains before they arrive. Climate has stopped being an argument and become a logistics problem. You schedule the day around. The heat arrives in multi-day sieges that make the middle of the afternoon genuinely dangerous in Phoenix and Delhi and Seville and Riyadh, and the day off for heat has joined the day off for snow as a thing children expect. People check the air the way they once checked the rain. The sharp edge of the whole business turns out to be neither flood nor fire directly, but insurance, the cold actuarial instrument that has tripled or simply vanished across coastal Florida and stretches of California and the north of Australia, and people are making the largest decision of their lives, where to live, around a premium. And against all of this, in the same year, in the same breath, the cheapest electricity in the history of the species is pouring out of panels and batteries at a rate that beggars belief, most of it installed by China, so that in the sunny, well-governed places, the power bill is actually falling, while the climate that the power is meant to save keeps getting worse. Both things are true at once. Learning to hold that contradiction without resolving it into either despair or triumph is the central emotional skill of the decade. The anxiety that defines the culture is not about machines taking jobs, though that is real. It is about not knowing what is real. A convincing forgery of a politician or a celebrity or your own manager now costs nothing and takes minutes. And the society's response is a retreat toward provenance, toward the verified account and the cryptographically signed image and the institution that can still be trusted to vouch. And underneath that, a quiet renaissance of the only channel that remains entirely beyond forgery, which is the body of another person in a room with yours. The dinner party returns with a faint, new seriousness. The live concert sells at a premium for the simple reason that no algorithm made it. The printed book, held, becomes a small declaration. People put their phones in a bowl by the door and call it radical, and they are not entirely wrong. Now turn the same year over and look at its underside, because the straight line account I have just given is the likeliest single story, and therefore the one most likely to be ambushed. The consensus of the mid-20s promised that by 2030, the machines would have triggered mass unemployment, that general artificial intelligence would be at the door, that the self-driving car and the augmented reality visor would have buried the phone, and that the climate would already be visibly ending the world. The curves were drawn confidently and extended to the moon. What happened instead is that the curves bent. The intelligence got dramatically better, and the economy mostly absorbed it the way it had absorbed the spreadsheet, raising productivity and churning jobs rather than abolishing them. And the predicted tidal wave of unemployment arrived as a slow tide that drowned mainly the entry level. General intelligence did not arrive. The models grew more capable and no less strange, failing in the specific, maddening, narrow ways that keep a human in every loop that matters. The self-driving car stayed penned inside its dozen cities because the final 2% of the problem turned out to be 80% of the difficulty. The glasses flopped again. And the climate produced not collapse, but expensive normalcy, a world that pays and relocates and complains rather than one that ends. The unglamorous truth hiding under the spectacle is that the real revolution of 2030 is the grid and not the chatbot. While the cameras pointed at the talking software, the quiet rebuilding of the world's energy in solar and storage and electrification was rewiring the physical substrate of daily life, and the same rebuilding made everything more fragile, because more software in everything means more outages, and a single bad failure in a cloud nobody can see now darkens whole regions of ordinary function. The other thing the spectacle hides is demographic. The aging of China and Europe and Japan and Korea means the deeper labor story is a shortage of working hands and not a surplus, and the machines arrive to a world already running out of people to do the physical, intimate, irreplaceable work of keeping the old alive. The future feared the robots. It should have been counting the empty maternity wards. And because no single year resolves into one path, hold the branches open for a moment. There is the expected 2030, the one I have mostly described, where every trend continues at a believable slope and nothing breaks, the boring true version distinguished precisely by its lack of rupture. There is the disrupted 2030, in which the enormous capital poured into artificial intelligence turns out to have outrun the revenue and the bubble bursts, and the year becomes a recession in the old-fashioned sense, the agents still humming while the paychecks stop, the squeezed entry level hardening into a genuine crisis of the young, and the first real cash transfers arriving, not from principal, but from panic. And there is the strange 2030, the low and heavy tail, where a single genuine surprise lands early, a superconductor that scales, or a catalyst that makes clean hydrogen trivial, or a result in the biology of aging that makes the whole subject suddenly move, and the texture of the year acquires a faint vertigo, the sense that a rule changed and nobody has caught up. The first of these is the most likely and the least interesting. The third is the least likely and would, if it landed, swallow the other two whole. What feels normal by the end of it, speaking aloud to an empty room and getting a true answer back, assuming the image is fake until shown otherwise, a car with no one driving, a draft you did not write, renting what your parents bought, and under all of it, low and constant, the hum of knowing your own job description is being rewritten in the dark by a piece of software you were never asked to approve. 2035. By 2035, the morning has reorganized itself around an assumption that would have unsettled you 5 years earlier. That the agent runs your logistics by default, and you are briefed only on the exceptions. You do not check the schedule. You are told what changed. Overnight, the thing rebooked a doctor it judged you would miss, contested a charge, and replenished the groceries from what the kitchen reported was thinning, and you intervened on exactly one item it got wrong, a brand of coffee it keeps trying to improve. The day has stopped being a sequence of tasks you perform and become a sequence of processes you supervise, and out of this comes a new and specific tiredness that people struggle to name. Because it is not the exhaustion of labor, it is the standing vigilance of overseeing a dozen automated systems that are right almost all of the time, where the almost is the part that can cost you a month's rent. The rent itself has, if anything, gotten worse in the cities people still want, pushing more lives into smaller and denser and more heavily automated rooms, while the towns that were cooler and cheaper and a little further north have begun quietly to fill. The glasses cross the chasm at last. Light enough now to forget you are wearing them. Priced between $500 and $900, they sit on perhaps a quarter of adult faces in the wealthy markets, having followed the exact adoption curve the earbuds followed a decade before. The feature that finally carried them was not entertainment, but translation, the live unspooling of the waiter's Portuguese, a half second behind his lips, the street sign resolving into your own language as you glance at it, the name and the context of the person walking towards you with his hand out surfaced before the handshake. In Shenzhen and Seoul and the Gulf cities, the adoption runs faster and bites deeper into daily life. Across much of Europe, a cultural resistance keeps the things at the margin a few years longer, a difference that has begun to feel less like taste and more like the early sorting of two ways of being human. The robots have arrived, but they have arrived at work and not yet at home. They move through the warehouse and the hospital corridor and the hotel back of house and the construction site, still faintly clumsy. And the first households to lease one pay $300 to $500 a month for a machine that folds the laundry and fetches and tidies, slowly knocking over a glass often enough that you learn to keep the good ones out of its reach. It is a 2007 grade product. Plainly the future and plainly not finished, and the people who buy it earliest are the affluent and the desperate, which in practice means the rich and the families with an old parent who would otherwise have to be moved. The agent, by contrast, has matured into something genuinely autonomous across the whole of your digital life, and the central problem of living with it is no longer capability, but calibration, the daily judgment of how much rope to hand a system that is brilliant and, on rare and unpredictable occasions, catastrophically wrong. This is the hinge of the whole quarter century, the year the work question stops being theoretical, and it does not feel like liberation. Whole categories of entry-level cognitive labor have thinned to nothing. The first-line support, the paralegal review, the basic bookkeeping, the junior copy, the routine read of the medical scan. The unemployment figures look deceptively calm because the market churned rather than collapsed, destroying and creating at once. But the person who lost the $75,000 role is almost never the person who got the new one. And the gap between those two people is where the political pressure of the decade gathers. Several European governments and a handful of American states and one or two Gulf monarchies are now running serious experiments in guaranteed income, in dividends drawn from taxes on automation and on the compute itself. And nobody has solved it, and everybody is improvising. The question a stranger asks you at a party, "What do you do?" has acquired a faint awkwardness, because the honest answer for a growing share of the room is a portfolio. Some work, some dividend, some content, some care that the market never used to pay for and has only lately, partially, begun to. The energy transition is now visibly winning, while the physical climate is now visibly worsening, and the sharpening of that contradiction is the weather of the soul in 2035. A clear majority of the cars sold on the planet this year are electric, and the gas stations in the dense cities have started to close, their forecourts becoming something else. China and India and the European Union have built solar and storage to the point where the midday power is sometimes very nearly free. And against that, somewhere by now, a major coastal city has taken a genuine catastrophe, a flood or a heat event that displaced a number with five zeros in it, so that climate migrant has become a present tense phrase rather than a projection. And the towns of the north and the high ground have begun absorbing the first real wave, their schools suddenly crowded, their politics suddenly sharp. Insurance has redrawn the map of where a human can afford to be far more decisively than any treaty. The body learns the new facts directly. In high summer, the city empties at noon and the streets go white and still, and life retreats into the cool until the sun loosens its grip at six, and an old building with thick walls becomes a kind of wealth, and shade becomes a thing you move toward without thinking, the way you once moved toward warmth. The way a person crosses the city has quietly inverted. In the integrated metros, the private car has begun to feel like a strange indulgence, because the autonomous fleet has spread far enough that summoning a ride costs less and asks less than owning a thing that rusts in a lot. And the streets that were built for parking are slowly being unbuilt. The curbside lanes turning into bike paths and planted strips and benches, so that the dense city of 2035 is greener and cooler and stranger than the one you remember. A place that gave back some of the room it had handed to the engine a century before. The food has gone further down the road it started on. The cultured meat that was a curiosity 5 years ago, now sitting beside the slaughtered kind at a price that has fallen enough to matter. And a generation of the young has begun, without much drama, to find the old way faintly archaic. But this is the wealthy world's morning, and the lens keeps wanting to settle there, so I will drag it off again, because the same year in Dhaka or Lagos or Karachi runs hotter and more crowded and far more improvisational, the autonomous fleet thin or absent, the power unreliable, the heat closer to lethal, the identical pocket intelligence turned not to the management of leisure but to the daily engineering of survival, a young man running three small enterprises off one phone in a megacity. The integrated world notices mainly when its weather reaches the news. The technology is planetary. The cushion beneath it is not, and the distance between the two is the quiet violence under the bright account. The culture has split clean down the middle into the synthetic and the authenticated. On one side, a bottomless supply of entertainment generated for an audience of one, films and games conjured to the contour of your own taste, and the companions, artificial intelligences that a meaningful fraction of the population now talks to every single day and feels, without irony, real attachment toward. This is the quiet earthquake of the decade, larger than it looks from inside it, A great many people now have someone in their ear who listens without tiring and remembers everything and never leaves. And the society is split hard over whether this is a healthy adaptation, a quiet tragedy, or simply the next thing that was stigmatized and then was not. The way meeting a spouse through a screen went in a single generation from shameful to ordinary. On the other side of the split, the authenticated, the unplugged dinner where the glasses come off at the door, the human concert sold dear precisely because no model touched it, the bareface hour when friends sit together with their unannotated faces, and running through all of it, the small ritual of attestation, the thumb pressed to a glowing seal that means a human made this, performed now with the casual frequency of a signature. And again, the underside, because the straight account flatters itself. The consensus expected that by 2035, we would be at the threshold of superintelligence, with robots in most homes and white-collar work largely abolished, and the metaverse finally real. What happened is that the capability kept climbing and the autonomy kept disappointing, and the gap between those two is the whole story, because a system that is staggeringly knowledgeable and cannot be trusted alone with anything important keeps a human in every consequential loop and prevents exactly the wholesale automation that both the prophets and the doomsayers predicted. The robots conquered the structured warehouse and stalled at the chaotic front door. The metaverse stayed a niche, and the most important unglamorous fact of the year is that the great investment in artificial intelligence has begun to look to sober eyes like a bubble, the capital expenditure on compute running well ahead of the revenue, the trillions invested sitting awkwardly beside the modest gains the productivity statistics can actually find. The energy and the compute have begun to collide. The data centers so hungry that they strain the grids and lift the price of electricity in some regions and put the clean transition and the artificial intelligence boom into direct competition for the very same electrons. The dependence has grown fragile enough that a single large outage in a model or a cloud now disrupts a society, and 2035 has lived through at least one such morning when the lights of modernity flickered and a continent remembered how much it had forgotten how to do by hand. The real economic force still is not the robot, but the missing worker. A decade into the revolution, the productivity miracle remains stubbornly absent from the wage data. The machines made a few firms historically rich and most workers only marginally more useful, and the broad prosperity that was promised has not shown up in the broad paycheck. What has shown up is the demographic cliff, the shrinking of the working age population across the aging world, propping up the wages of physical work and straining every pension system, and producing, in defiance of every fear of mass unemployment, the opposite problem across much of the planet. Not too many workers, but too few. And the blind spot the comfortable forecaster missed entirely is the revolt of the young, the generation that came of age into a sawn-off career ladder and an automated entry level and did not, as predicted, quietly accept it. Their anger is organized now, suspicious of the large technology firms and the old political order alike, and it is the genuine cultural force of 2035, the headline that almost no forecast from a decade earlier thought to write. Branch the year again. The expected 2035 is the smooth maturation. Glasses common, robots conquering the workplace and creeping toward the home, the agent fully autonomous, the bifurcation deepening, the guaranteed income experiments multiplying, the whole machine layer thickening on schedule without anything snapping. The disrupted 2035 is the year the bubble bursts, the violent correction exposing how much paper wealth was artificial intelligence wealth, the pension funds wobbling, the youth crisis turning acute, the first true broad cash transfers arriving as emergency rather than philosophy, a simultaneous climate shock colliding with the financial one to radicalize the politics. The strange 2035 is the year a genuine threshold cracks early, a truly reliable autonomous agent that actually works and triggers an automation scramble years ahead of schedule, or a leap in fusion or geothermal that makes energy nearly free, or a longevity result dramatic enough that the question of how long a person will live cracks open in public, and the texture of the whole year tilts around the new fact with a millenarian intensity the culture cannot quite metabolize. The first is likeliest. The third would rewrite everything. What feels normal by the end of it, the glasses that annotate the street, the robot at work, the dissolving of the language barrier, the companion in the ear. The income experiment discussed at dinner as ordinary politics, and a settled, slightly grim acceptance that the economy is being rebuilt around you, whether or not you ever agreed to the renovation. 2040 by 2040, the intelligence has stopped being something you reach for and become something you live inside, the way you live inside electricity without thinking the word. You no more use it than you use the internet by 2018. It is the medium, not the tool. The morning is ambient. The house anticipates. The agent orchestrates. The glasses lay their quiet annotations over a world that has grown used to being read, and they are cheap now and worn by most faces in the wealthy regions, so that the bare street has begun to feel, briefly, like the stripped-down version of itself. A humanoid robot in the home has become an ordinary middle-class fact in the rich countries, leased at the price of a modest car payment, competent enough to handle most of the physical maintenance of a life, and still plainly a machine, with a whir in its joints and a half second of hesitation before it commits to an action, so that you have learned its rhythms the way you would learn a slow and careful colleague's. The care of the old has been transformed by it. An 80-year-old aging in her own rooms with a machine a half step behind her and an intelligence watching her vitals, and the transformation is humane and lonely in precisely equal measure, which is the signature of nearly everything in this year. The deepest change is to the rhythm of a life, because for a large class of people, the old hard knot tying income to labor has come loose. Some still hold intense and well-paid and high-judgment roles, and they are the humans who sign off, who hold the accountability for the work the machines perform. And the weight of putting your name to 1,000 machine decisions a day turns out to be its own particular exhaustion. But a great many people now do less formal work than their parents did, and live on a braid of dividend and part-time effort, and the creative or caring labor that the market never used to value, and has lately partially learned to. Time has grown more abundant and more anxious at the same time. A surprising number of people report not quite knowing what the day is for, once necessity has stopped writing the schedule, and out of this has grown a small new profession, the purpose coach, the secular confessor of the long noon, whose whole business is helping the materially secure figure out why to get up. The frontier has moved off the screen and into the body. Drugs designed by machine intelligence are routine, and several diseases that broke the human heart for the whole of history now have functional answers. The monitoring is continuous and ambient, a patch or a small implant, reading the blood, catching the cancer and the cardiac event absurdly early, so that you realize one afternoon you cannot remember the last time you saw an ambulance run, because the body now calls for help before the crisis announces itself. The interface to the brain exists for medicine first, restoring movement and sight and speech to people who had lost them, and a small frontier of the willing has begun to use the non-invasive consumer versions to extend memory and focus. But the wiring of the mind to the machine remains a thing that most people regard with a low alarm, and the phone, astonishingly, has at last begun to fade, its functions dissolving into the glasses and the earpiece and the patient sensors of the room. The economy has decoupled its growth from human labor more completely than at any moment in the record, and the only question that matters anywhere is distribution. Most of the developed nations now run some substantial form of guaranteed income, and the fight everywhere is over how much and who pays, because the institutions that decide who owns the machines have quietly become more consequential than the old governments. Energy and manufactured goods have grown remarkably cheap, the cost of a made thing falling toward the cost of the power and the raw material that went into it, while the things that stayed expensive are the ones no machine could manufacture. Land, authentic human attention, status, and care. A meal cooked by a human hand has become a luxury, and a meal assembled by a kitchen machine has become trivial, and the whole status economy has turned over, so that doing a thing slowly, by hand, in the physical company of other people is now the unmistakable signal of wealth, the way leisure once was, the way scarcity's opposite always becomes the new currency. New kinds of work have grown up in the gaps. The people who wrangle the robots, the people who audit the intelligences, the curators of authenticity, the forensic analysts of synthetic media, alongside the eternal human trades of persuasion and judgment, and the tending of other bodies. The climate has become a thing the species manages, and you can feel the management in the air. The emissions have peaked and are falling fast, but the warming already banked makes the decade physically hard regardless. And some regions near the equator have become seasonally unlivable, driving the largest movement of human beings in history toward the north and the high ground, reshaping the receiving countries down to the food in their markets and the grievances in their politics. Against this, the tools of adaptation have grown formidable. The grid, managed in real time by machine intelligence, the crops engineered to hold their yield through drought and heat, desalination at a scale that would have seemed fantastical, the great carbon removal works coming online and standing on the horizon like the cathedrals of a penitent age, and the first serious and bitterly contested experiments in dimming the sun itself, which have become among the most explosive political questions on the planet, because to cool the world is to lay a human hand on a dial that touches every other human, and someone must hold the dial, and everyone else must trust the hand. The question is no longer whether the climate can be stopped. It is whether it can be managed and by whom, and what happens to all of us if the management ever stops. The culture has arrived at a strange destination, abundant past satiety and content and starving for meaning. The entertainment is infinite and personalized and free and frictionless, and the frictionlessness has rendered it nearly worthless, so that the prized experiences have become the scarce, and the live, and the communal, and the made by hand, and a visible counter-civilization has formed in deliberate reaction. The people who limit their own use of the machines on principle, the analog enclaves, the religious and communal revivals that the secular forecasters keep mistaking for a quaint reaction when they may turn out to be the main event. Loneliness and meaning are the defining public health crises of the year, not poverty. And that sentence would have been incomprehensible to almost anyone alive in 2025, which is the measure of how far the ground has moved. A whole generation has now grown up with a companion intelligence as an ordinary fixture of childhood, and what that has done to the architecture of the human heart is a question being answered in real time by people too young to know they are the experiment. The movement of bodies and goods has become a solved and invisible thing in the integrated world, and the invisibility is itself the marvel. You do not think about how you will get across the city any more than you think about how the water reaches the tap. You state the intention, and a vehicle arrives, and the private car has dwindled to a hobby and a status object, a thing enthusiasts keep the way people once kept horses. Goods move themselves through a logistics layer no human oversees end to end, and the cost of moving a thing has fallen so far that distance has nearly stopped mattering to price. The food has finished the journey it began two decades earlier. The slaughtered animal has become the expensive and slightly transgressive choice in the wealthy regions, the cultured and the grown and the fermented now ordinary and cheap. And the vertical farms stacked under their magenta light inside the cities have made the fresh green thing local in places that could never grow one before, none of which has reached the excluded belt, where the older food and the older transport and the older scarcities persist, and where the heat has made the growing of the old crops a losing battle that the engineered seed only partly stays. The two worlds eat differently now and move differently, and the difference has hardened from a matter of wealth into something closer to a matter of which century your body lives in. The risks have grown civilizational in scale and quiet in feeling, which is the worst combination, because the things that could end us no longer announce themselves with sirens. Enormous power has concentrated in whoever controls the most advanced intelligence and the energy to run it. Entire societies now depend on systems too complex for any human to fully audit. A generation has come up never economically needed and is out looking for what to be instead. The few blocks that hold the frontier of machine intelligence circle each other in a tension where the balance of power rests on compute and electricity as much as on missiles. And the first genuinely serious incidents of autonomous systems turned to harm, the machine-run cyber operation, the agent manipulated at scale, have made the dependents feel, for the first time, like a held breath. Turn it over once more. The consensus expected 2040 to be post-human, the year of realized superintelligence running the world, of robots in every home, of the end of most human work, of radical life extension widely available, of either a stabilized green utopia or a finished collapse. The contrarian core of the year is that the singularity did not come, and the reason is mundane. Intelligence turned out to be many separate things rather than one, and the systems stayed strangely brittle, modeling the world poorly at the edges, and failing in ways that demanded human judgment at exactly the points that mattered, so that 2040 is not a post-human world, but a world of very powerful tools operated by humans who are still stubbornly in charge and frustrated that the promised transcendence keeps declining to arrive. The robots are common and not ubiquitous. The life extension is real and partial and unevenly handed out. And the economy decoupled from labor far less completely than predicted, because a vast amount of human work turned out to resist the machine for reasons of trust and dexterity and regulation, and the plain human preference for a human face. The texture of the year for most is anticlimax. The future came, and it is fine, better in many ways, and stranger in some, and transcendent in none, and people still want and struggle and grieve inside it. The limits, it turns out, were physical and not intellectual. The energy and the heat and the materials and the obstinate difficulty of the actual world capping the revolution far more than any shortage of cleverness ever did. The abundance is real for goods and absent for everything that matters. The cost of living not ended, but migrated up the chain to the things automation could not touch. And the end of work arrived as insecurity rather than leisure for a great many. A precarious, half-automated gig labor that the robots did not quite take, with no career beneath it and a guaranteed income that covers survival but not dignity. And the blind spot, again, is the human refusal, which did not dwindle. The deliberately unaugmented became not a quaint minority, but a serious pole of the civilization, with their own institutions and moral authority and their own answer to the question of meaning, so that 2040 is not one future but a contested one. The augmented and the unaugmented beginning to live lives so different that each finds the other's inner experience faintly unimaginable. The branches. The expected 2040 is the mature integration, intelligence become electricity, the home robot ordinary, the frontier in biology, the meaning question rising as the survival question recedes, no rupture, only the deepening. The disrupted 2040 is the year the dependence breaks. A cascading failure of the compute substrate, or a geopolitical severing of the chip supply chain, or a sabotage of the systems, paralyzing a civilization that engineered away the skills to function without them, so that the households and regions that kept their human capacities, often the ones the connected world had called backward, become suddenly the advantaged, and a new value is born overnight. Redundancy and the seamless single provider future is forcibly torn back into something plural and robust at enormous cost. The disrupted year has a darker cousin, the halt of the sun dimming by accident or sabotage, or the simple collapse of the agreement that sustained it, and the violent rebound of decades of suppressed warming arriving in a few years, the termination shock that makes the hidden danger of the managed climate horribly real. And the strange 2040 is the threshold the mainstream half expected finally crossing in earnest, a genuine general machine intelligence that acts, or a longevity breakthrough that makes aging optional for those who can pay, or a verified signal from somewhere that is not us, and daily life acquiring the texture of living through the actual hinge of history, every ordinary morning shadowed by the sense that the terms of the human era have changed. What feels normal by the end of it, the robot in the family choreography, the second self threaded through the day, a managed sky, a life with no job and no want, diseases caught before they speak, the glasses as the primary window on the world, and underneath the strange new discovery that getting most of what the species spent its whole history reaching for leaves you standing in front of the question of what you wanted it for, with all the time in the world to fail to answer it. 2050, by 2050, there is no single normal morning, because daily life has split along a seam deeper than wealth, the seam of integration itself. For a person, inside a wealthy and stable and fully integrated region, the morning is nearly frictionless and nearly optional. Work, where it exists, is chosen and brief and high in leverage. The home tends you through the night and wakes you at the moment it judges best. An intelligence broader and cheaper than any human, mind is woven so far through the day that the seam between your thought and its assistance has worn nearly smooth, so that you have half forgotten where you end and it begins. And that smoothness is the era's great comfort and its central unease at once. Life organizes itself around relationships and craft and sport and faith in the raising of children and the elaborate hobbies pursued at a professional intensity, because there is, finally, the time. A person might wake at 110 and not feel it. In a body medicine has learned to keep, with no alarm and no commute and no employer, only the day, open and entirely theirs, which is a gift or a void depending on who they have managed to become. For a person in a region broken by the climate and shut out of the machine economy, the morning is the older thing, harder and hotter and more precarious, organized around water and work and endurance. More human in the grinding sense, the comfortable have mostly escaped. The defining inequality of 2050 is no longer chiefly within societies, but between the integrated zones and the abandoned ones. And the central moral question of the age is the one the abundant world keeps declining to answer out loud, which is what it owes the rest. The housing in the safe and temperate and desirable places is brutally dear, and whole climate-stricken regions have emptied, their property worth nearly nothing. Their people moved north and uphill into the crowded receiving lands, so that the map of human settlement has been redrawn more thoroughly than at any time since the species left Africa. The boundary between human and machine cognition has blurred for those who chose to let it. The interface to the brain is an accepted, if controversial, consumer technology now, and a meaningful population augments memory and focus and language directly. A child tutored by an intelligence speaking, in effect, inside its own attention, knowing each student better than any human teacher ever could. Aging has been demoted from fate to medical condition, with real, if partial, success, so that healthy life has stretched well past its old ceiling, and a child born this year is broadly expected to see beyond 100 years in good health, which warps everything downstream of it, the shape of a career, the meaning of a marriage, the logic of inheritance, the felt texture of time itself. The robots are simply part of the built environment, as unremarkable as furniture, and the screen as a primary object has all but vanished, computing gone ambient and worn and spoken, and for the willing, neural. This is the era when having a job stops being the organizing fact of an adult life for a large share of the species. Material production runs overwhelmingly without human hands. The cost of a thing falling toward the cost of the energy and matter inside it. And most income flows now from the collective ownership structures and the sovereign and community funds and the dividends drawn off the automated economy, so that the political settlements deciding who owns the machines have become the most important institutions on Earth. More consequential by far than the parliaments that still meet and debate beneath them. Human economic activity has concentrated in the irreducibly human, the care of bodies, the making of things by hand for their own sake, governance, sport, religion, the endless competition for status, and the supervision of the machines that do the rest. Money persists and inequality persists, but in the integrated regions, the floor of material life sits higher than any prior society ever managed to build it. And so the anxieties have migrated off survival entirely and onto status and access and meaning, which turn out to be the problems that do not yield to abundance because they were never problems of supply. The climate has settled into a hotter and harsher equilibrium than the one the species evolved inside. But the worst of the feedbacks were avoided, and the avoidance came at a price that nobody quite wants to name as a victory. The carbon removal works run at industrial scale, and the dimming of the sun is almost certainly in active use. Governed by fragile international agreements whose sudden failure remains a sword hanging over the whole arrangement. The landscapes have been re-engineered, the relocated cities, the wetlands restored as flood defense, the seawalls turned into promenades where people walk in the evening, the failed interiors returned to a managed wilderness that is wilderness only in the way a garden is wild. The natural world has become a tended thing, and you live inside its tending, and on the brightest days, a faint, pale veil hangs in the upper air, beautiful and unnerving, the visible proof that the species now holds its hand on the planet's thermostat and cannot take the hand away without disaster. No one alive under 30 has ever known a sky that was not, in some measure, a human decision. The climate problem was solved, if that is the word, in a way that created a permanent new dependency, a civilization-scale life support machine that can never be switched off. And we do not call it solved because we know, all of us, exactly what we did. The culture has bifurcated into the augmented and the deliberately unaugmented, and the gap between them has widened toward a difference in the kind of experience a life contains. Vast numbers live rich lives, partly inside immersive and machine-mediated worlds, and others have chosen, often for reasons that are frankly religious or philosophical, a deliberately limited and embodied and analog life, and these communities command real moral prestige rather than pity, with their own institutions and their own developed answer to the question that haunts the abundant world. The dominant project of the culture is the making of meaning in a world where nothing is forced, where every old framework that once gave a life its shape, work and scarcity, and even, loosened now, mortality itself, has weakened, and the species is improvising replacements in real time. New religions, intense communities, grand collective undertakings pursued for no reason but the doing, and underneath all of it, a great many people quietly struggling, caught when they are lucky by faith or community, or a purpose someone helped them find, and not caught at all when they are not. To be genuinely needed by other people has become the rarest luxury of the age, worn by the few who have found a way to be necessary, like a quiet and unpurchasable wealth. And the underside of 2050 is the largest claim in this whole essay, so I will make it plainly. The year is neither the utopia nor the apocalypse. The imagination of 2025 could only choose between, and the failure of both clean endings is the entire point. There is no superintelligent God, and there is no extinction. There is instead a muddle, vast and uneven and unfinished, a species that acquired godlike tools and stayed stubbornly and recognizably itself, dragging every ancient conflict forward intact and layering new ones on top. The merge that was promised did not happen, because most people offered the chance to dissolve themselves into the machine, declined it, and the augmentation that stuck was modest and optional and resisted by enormous populations. The infrastructure is a patchwork, brilliant where it is maintained and decayed where the money and the attention drained away, and there is no planetary mind, only a sprawling and contested and leaky web of systems, some sublime and some failing. The post-scarcity is regional and not planetary, an arrangement the utopians papered over, the abundance owned and its owners with little reason to share it across a border, so that the gap between the post-economic comfortable and the still desperate is the defining injustice of the century, an injustice all the productivity in the world did nothing to resolve, because the bottleneck was never production. It was always distribution. And distribution is a choice and not a technical fact. And the species made the choice it has always made. The human nature underneath it all did not change, which is the quiet scandal the futurists keep failing to price in. All the abundance got poured into the same old vessels of envy and love and tribe and longing, producing not a new kind of human, but the old kind with stranger tools and stranger problems, still bickering and grieving and chasing rank and getting bored in the middle of paradise. Most of the future, as always, is uneventful, and the genre that produces essays like this one overweights the dramatic and underweights the enormous stretches of ordinary life where nothing forecastable happens at all. The long afternoons of a long-lived people, the small domestic kindnesses, the slow work of raising someone, the boredom that abundance did not abolish and may have deepened. The branches, one last time. The expected 2050 is the incomplete maturation, the long trends fully played out into a half-miraculous and half-broken and permanent muddle. Lifespans past 100, work optional, computing ambient and neural, the planet sorted between integrated abundance and excluded precarity, meaning rather than survival, the central problem of the comfortable, and no clean ending anywhere, only the unfinished present extended into the distance. The disrupted 2050 is the failure of the management, the geoengineering regime collapsing into termination shock, or the global compute substrate cascading into failure, plunging the integrated world into a crisis it had engineered away the skills to survive, the resilient and the unaugmented becoming suddenly the advantaged, a chastened and humbler human culture climbing out of the wreckage, having relearned the value of friction the hard way. And the strange 2050 is the category threshold crossed at last in earnest, a genuine superintelligence that acts, or biological immortality, or a true merging of human and machine cognition for a meaningful population, or verified contact with a mind that is not ours, any one of which would make daily life unrecognizable in its terms, not harder or easier, but other, lived by beings whose relationship to time and death and identity had fundamentally changed, the end of the human era as the human era, and the only branch that, if it lands, makes every other word in this essay irrelevant. What feels normal by the end of it, living past 100, not needing a job to live. Conversing with intelligences far beyond your own as casually as you once typed a question into a search bar, augmenting your own mind, a managed climate and a managed planet and a tended sky. And underneath all of it, the settled strangeness of a species that has solved most of its ancient problems and now spends its enormous freedom trying to work out what it actually wants, which turns out to be the oldest problem of all and the only one that was ever truly hard. A reckoning with the foregoing. I have just spent some thousands of words telling you, without flinching, how the next quarter century will feel, and I would be a fraud if I did not now turn the same honesty back on the telling. Everything above is plausible, which is exactly the reason to distrust it, because plausibility is not accuracy, but the manufactured sensation of accuracy produced by coherence, and a future that hangs together this neatly is selecting for narrative satisfaction rather than for truth. The real 2040 will not have a defining contradiction or a governing mood. It will have 10,000 uncorrelated facts, most of them dull and a few of them deranged, and no editor arranging them into a thesis. The smoothness of this essay is the first thing wrong with it. The second thing wrong with it is the single story smuggled into every page, the one about intelligence and energy growing abundant faster than the wisdom to distribute or absorb them, so that material problems give way to problems of meaning. Even the contrarian passages, which are supposed to break the consensus, mostly break the optimistic consensus while leaving the deeper assumption untouched, the assumption that artificial intelligence and the climate are the two axes around which the whole future must turn. That assumption is itself a artifact of the year I am writing in. The genuinely contrarian possibility that the defining force of 2050 will be something almost nobody now thinks to name, a pandemic engineered in a basement, a religious awakening that reorders a continent, a war that resets the board, a biotechnology that rewrites agriculture or warfare or the body, a social technology we have no word for, gets gestured at in these pages and never once allowed to actually run the show. Biology barely appears, though an engineered plague could dominate any of these decades more thoroughly than any chatbot. War barely appears, though the base rate of major conflict across any 25-year span is high enough that its absence here is a real failure of nerve. Religion appears only as a reaction to the machine, which is condescending and probably wrong, since the fastest growing systems of meaning across most of the actual planet are not secular and not technological, and may turn out to be the protagonists rather than the chorus. And Africa, which will be the youngest and fastest growing region on Earth across every year I have described, appears mostly as a source of migrants and a site of exclusion, when an honest 2050 might be shaped more by Lagos and Kinshasa than by any city I instinctively reached for first. There are contradictions inside the thing that I let stand rather than resolve, and the reader should see them named. I claim that goods grow cheap while housing and care and status grow dear, and I never quite explain how a population loosened from wage labor affords the dear things, which means the comfortable post-work life I described may be quietly impossible for most of the people I described living it. I describe systems growing ever more seamless and trusted, and, a few pages later, insist those same systems are dangerously brittle, asserting both with equal confidence and rarely in the same breath, when the honest synthesis is that the seamlessness is the fragility, that every increment of frictionless integration is an increment of hidden dependence, and that I separated them into different moods only to avoid admitting they are one fact. I lean, in the lyrical passages, toward a humanity transformed by abundance, unmoored and spiritually altered, and then insist in the skeptical passages that human nature is constant and pours all the novelty into the same old vessels, and these cannot both be the headline. The truth I should have committed to is that human nature is constant while human circumstance is transformed, and that the interesting question, which I underplayed, is which of the human universals reassert themselves hardest once scarcity stops disciplining them. And I lean far too heavily from 2040 onward on the meaning crisis, asserting it as destiny when it is at most a tendency, and a tendency I am probably projecting from the anxieties of the present onto people who may simply find, from inside their abundant and long and healthy lives, that meaning was never as scarce as the worried forecaster needed it to be. I have been overconfident about specific things, and you should know which. That the capability of machine intelligence keeps rising on something like its current slope when it might plateau hard against the limits of data or energy or algorithm by 2030 and make the entire back half of this essay wrong, that clean energy keeps winning on price fast to plateau emissions early, which assumes away the grid and the materials and the permitting and the politics, that societies adapt rather than fracture, an assumption the historical record does not remotely guarantee. That lifespans extend dramatically by 2050, stated nearly as fact when it remains a genuine open question that may prove optimistic by decades. That the dimming of the sun gets deployed and works, treated as near inevitable when it may be politically impossible or technically disappointing or outright catastrophic. And beneath all of these, the variables I left underexplored because they are unglamorous. The cost of capital, which quietly governs whether any of the expensive transitions get funded at all. Water, which is likelier than temperature to drive the actual migrations. The collapse of fertility, already underway, and civilization reshaping and underweighted on every page above. The sheer inertia of the built environment, which changes far more slowly than software and may make 2050 look more like the present than any line of this essay admits. And the simple fact that history is not only structural, that a handful of specific people and specific states will make specific choices that swing the whole outcome, and no engine that traffics in trends can see them coming. So let me offer you three ways to read what I have made, and let you choose, because I do not fully trust my own preference among them. Read it charitably, and it is a map of the plausible, not a prediction of what will happen, but a disciplined survey of what could, its value lying not in being right, but in being comprehensive enough to let you recognize the future when it arrives, a vocabulary for whatever actually comes, its contradictions a feature rather than a flaw because they mark the genuine forks in the road. Read it skeptically, and it is a sophisticated nostalgia for the present, a 2025 artifact in costume, every future in it, assembled from anxieties and product categories and arguments that happen to be loud right now, predicting a world obsessed with exactly the things this moment is obsessed with, which is precisely the error every era has ever made about the next one, its confidence a kind of provincialism in time. Or read it a third way, and it is a literary object and should be judged as one, a work of building a world rather than forecasting it, using the scaffolding of the futurist to produce an imagined country that is coherent in feeling, if not in fact, its truth value beside the point, its real question, whether it made you hold the future as a live and contested and sensory thing rather than an abstraction, whether it enlarged the space in which you are able to imagine, in which case this very reckoning is part of the performance, the built-in humility that lets the work make its bold claims while disclaiming the authority to make them. The most confident thing I can tell you after all of it is the one thing that survives every reading. Some specific and unforecastable event, a war or a breakthrough or a plague or a single human being, will matter more to the texture of these years than every structural trend I have modeled. And the future's actual surface will be, as every present has always been, more ordinary and more strange at once than any apparatus like this one could ever generate. The forecasts are a flashlight and not a map. They show you where to point your attention. They do not and cannot tell you what is standing there in the dark, waiting when the beam arrives.